and welcome to another Directions Magazine podcast. This is Joe Francica, Editor-in-Chief. Today I'll be speaking to Eric Cadora, the Director of the Justice Mapping Center. Cadora is using mapping technology to identify the problems associated with incarceration policy within the criminal justice system. He has identified patterns that have radically changed the conversation among policymakers and informed them about why it isn't policy that is truly driving incarceration rates, but something else they didn't understand until they huddled around some of Cadora's maps. This is one of the more fascinating interviews I've conducted. I hope you'll enjoy it as well. Stay tuned. Eric, thanks once again for taking the time to talk with me today. And I wonder if we could just start off with an overview of the Justice Mapping Center, how it got started, and the funding organizations supporting the center.
Oh, well, sure, Joe. It's the center has been a long evolved operation of mine, which technically started in 2006. But the work that it does really began way back in 1998, when we first started to think about how to crack the sort of conversation on crime that we were involved in the U.S. back then. The Justice Mapping Center is really focused on this issue of mass incarceration, a phenomenon which has become a major national issue as a result of changes over the last 35 years in the U.S. in terms of criminal justice policies around incarceration. And just as a sort of foundation for understanding that, you know, the U.S. had a pretty steady incarceration rate for almost 100 years till about the mid-70s when as a result of all sorts of developments, both political and, you might say, geodemographical, the incarceration rate skyrocketed 400% in 35 years. So about 100 years of steady incarceration rates till the 70s, and now we imprison about 2 million people, where before that jump we were imprisoning about 200,000. So it's that frames the start of our thinking and my work around the Justice Mapping Center. And at that time, you have to understand there was, you know, the conversation on crime in the U.S. was still one in which one began, whatever one said or position they took, they were quickly pigeonholed into a kind of getting tough or being soft kind of polemic. And what we wanted to do was try to find out another way to reframe that conversation, so that we could avoid that and let people really get more involved in discussing these policies. But to do that, what struck me was that, you know, and I was in that sort of world of trying to rethink and public education around this issue, it was what appeared to me to be necessary was not just sort of more clamoring about it so much as a different data framework to change the terms of the discussion. And at the time, you know, I've been looking at things like crime mapping and hotspot mapping, which at that time, you know, were really about tactical kinds of measures and law enforcement. And what I was more interested in was a broader thinking about, you know, national and local policies. And I started to think about that and ran across other uses of GIS. The one I most remember is litigation around predatory lending and the role that GIS was playing in proving sort of bank redlining policies and so on. Right. And that helped me really rethink sort of how we might pivot the crime mapping data into a different kind of conversation, which was focused on the residential data about where people live who go in and out of prison every year. And the reason for thinking that way was it was going to likely be a very disproportionate picture, and it was going to be a picture that started with communities and neighborhoods first, which I believed would enable us to have a discussion that went around, sort of circumnavigated that getting tough, being soft polemic by using data that was at a neighborhood level that would help us discuss neighborhoods and communities rather than politics so much and punishment. And I had a sense of what it would show. And we started, I had at the time I was a researcher, the director of research at an alternatives to prison agency, sort of the biggest one in the country at the time in New York. And we worked with the state a lot to exchange data and compare projects and so on. And so we were very involved with exchanging. And I asked our partners at the state if we could add residence level address information to the records we were getting. And back then it wasn't all about signing all kinds of disclosures and so on. We just exchanged data and worked on it. And we produced our first maps of where people live, the locally concentrated phenomenon of mass incarceration for New York City, and found some astonishing, if not unsurprising, pictures of a justice system that looked different than what we thought it was supposed to be about, which was this kind of individual case-by-case decision-making.
Right.
But the mapping results showed us something quite different. Right. That got us started. And so we just started to explore thinking about that kind of issue by looking more and more in depth at that data. And it evolved over the years to where I worked at the Open Society Institute, a grant-making foundation focused on criminal justice and so on. And from there, used the mapping work that we did to start a number of interesting initiatives. And was, of course, able to work with using the foundation, support, to really get some interesting work going out in the country around this. So after that, we sort of went independent. That is, the work we were doing at the Open Society Institute was growing so much that we had to make a decision about whether to stay there, you know, as a grant maker, or become, you know, a project on our own. And so, you know, that's when I split off and started the Justice Mapping Center officially. And the Open Society Institute was, of course, the first funder of that project, as was the Jet Foundation. And yeah, and from then we've had support from the Ford Foundation. We got support from the Pew Charitable Trusts, and so on. And then we've done a number of projects that were sort of collaborations with other agencies for which we were supported.
Let me go back to your note about how you were able to determine the shifting geodemographic situation. That must have been a revealing set of data that pointed to things that regarding incarceration rates. So I wonder if you could just explain how that all was revealed to you in some of the work that you did.
Perhaps the most notary example of how we were starting to understand that data in a way that could do what we were first interested in doing, shift the conversation a little bit. So we found, you know, concentrated incarceration rate phenomenon where, for example, in the city of New York, we found that 50% of the people who were going to prison from the city came from 17% of the neighborhoods, right? And so that was not only had never been done empirically, that is, no one had ever mapped these kinds of data, the residences of people going in and out of prisons and jails, but no one had ever seen the phenomenon sort of in a map. And maps, of course, are just in and of themselves a very powerful and compelling visualization of quantitative data in a way that's really easily understood by a whole set of different kinds of people, from legislators to researchers to other stakeholders and the lay public. And so the maps of Brooklyn and the concentrations of neighborhood incarceration and reentry really struck a chord. And it struck a chord in me also, not only because I expected these things then, but rather that this was introduced a demographic set of terminology, almost, that we could use to describe the locally concentrated mass incarceration phenomenon, which was important because those were neutral sorts of terms and enabled us to help, in fact, everyone, including, and this was perhaps the most gratifying initial results, it enabled legislators to simply start talking about public safety and criminal justice out loud in public in a way that did exactly what we were talking about, at least skirted the getting tough, being soft polemic, and enabled them to start talking about and doing a realistic, open assessment of what criminal justice policies, particularly incarceration, were netting as a return in a public safety investment, you might say.
Right.
And it was those terms, that those kind of findings and those terms, like return on investment, that also led us to what I was going to suggest was the perhaps most noted kind of public expression of this data, and that was when we euphemistically discovered what we euphemistically, I'm sorry, called million-dollar blocks. Because what we did was we, since we had the data and had mapped, you know, the census tracts and block groups and blocks from which people were going to prison, and we knew how many of them there were, we knew how long they were going to prison, and we knew how much it cost per day. So we were then able to translate the person incarceration map into a money map that showed block by block how much was the state of New York, for example, and the city of New York spending to incarcerate people from that block each year for, on average, 2.5 to 3.5 years, and then return them.
Right.
And we discovered, for example, in Brooklyn, 35 individual census blocks for which the state was spending more than $1 million a year to incarcerate people.
Did it have an impact on policy when this was realized to legislators, or did it have an impact more or less at the local level, community-based policing, when this kind of information reached policymakers and politicians specifically?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I mean, it was it, among those two, it was the former first, policymaking at the higher jurisdictional state level, than it was perhaps in terms of operational tactics at the local city level. And even with policy, you know, policy is long and changing. And this particular policy, incarceration and criminal justice, is doubly so. So the first, as I was suggesting, first indications of change were really conversation, that this discussion started to happen. But the first real result in policymaking changes in the states that resulted from this was an initiative called the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, which I began at the when I was at the Open Society Institute by funding the project to work with a group of technical assistance experts and government public education organizations to propose and fund technical assistance in states that wanted to examine the drivers of their prison populations. Why were their prison populations continuing to rise despite historical drops in crime rates across the country? States at that time were somewhat prone, in fact, to asking that question, where is the dividend in reductions in my prison costs for this massive radical drop in crime that the United States experienced beginning in the mid and late 90s and going into the first decade of 2000. So we started supporting groups and, in fact, worked with them over the next 5 years or so, going from state to state, helping them identify the drivers of their prison population, helping them understand options for gaining control and reducing those prison populations safely and with no change in crime rates, and then looking at and exploring new ways to, in fact, reinvest the associated savings in prison dollars in and for the benefit of those high incarceration million-dollar block neighborhoods. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, it's interesting because if you went state to state, were there any similar patterns that you could discern from the data? In other words, were there things that were common from state to state? I find it interesting that while the crime rate drops, the prison population increases, and whether you could relate that to isolating something geographically that would either be similar from state to state or would be so disparate that that, yeah. you know, that you could point to something and say, look, you guys are doing something here that, you know, New York is doing something that Kansas may not be.
Right, right. No, it's a great question, and it's the right question. I mean, it's the question you always hear, because in it, in the question, Joe, is a mythology that our work has always been sort of focused on helping dispel. And that is that the incarceration rate is primarily determined by the crime rate. And this is unfortunately a mythology, and a normal one, a natural one to imagine, because the slightly nuanced understanding is that incarceration is primarily affected by incarceration policy, not crime rate. And of course, crimes and crime rates are in fact most determined by megatrends in the labor market and employment, etc. So the massive drop in crime that the country experienced was in fact very closely related to the giant economic boon experienced in the 90s and early 2000s before the recessions. And that has been what our geography and our findings in fact reinforced from state to state. What's remarkable about what we found in common, as you were suggesting, in state after state, was how in fact similar, if not identical, the patterns of incarceration were from place to place. That is, they were very often distributed in almost identical ways, in which somewhere around 20%, 15 to 20% of the neighborhoods were home to 50% of people being sent to prison each year. Mm-hmm. And that was holding true everywhere.
Just like you found in New York, right? Yeah.
Exactly as we found in New York. And that reflected the, and was correlated with the rapid, well, the evolved over time, the 20, 30 year rush to mass incarceration policies that the entire country and each state, one by one, initiated over those 30 years. I mean, these were the war on drug laws, the three strikes you're out laws, the mandatory minimum laws, the, you know, reduction in judicial discretion laws, all these legislative omnibuses, so to speak, over the years, were rampant throughout the country and are, you know, reflected in the locally concentrated, isolated pockets of incarceration patterns that we found in every city,
right.
regardless of crime rate.
Right. So maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, it almost sounds as if the incarceration policies, and I think you just said this, had more of an impact than what we tend to think of as a massive sociodemographic or socioeconomic shift during these boom and bust periods, especially the Great Recession period, where, yeah, the rich really survived and the poor got worse. So socioeconomically, we knew that shift was happening, but it almost sounds as if it's the incarceration policies that have more of an impact on prison population. Is that correct, or am I missing something there? And could those patterns be revealed, in a mapping application?
Well, you're spot on. That is exactly correct. And you can't say it any plainer than that. And, you know, researcher after researcher will also tell you that, regardless of sort of political orientation, that in fact, the most anyone attributes, any researchers have attributed, crime rates, impacting incarceration rates has been about 25% of any change. So that the vast majority of change in incarceration rates are due entirely to policies, in fact, discretionary policies on all sorts of levels. And it's that I think the discussion about that the mapping was starting to reveal and suggest that, you know, why are, you know, how can these places be reconsidered in terms of public safety if we understand this relationship between our policies and what's happening in these neighborhoods.
Right. And you would think that there would be some efforts made by police and public safety agencies to act on that. Let me ask you a quick question about, you published the Atlas of Criminal Justice, and I would be curious to know who's been the most active users of that Atlas and who feel its utility most of all.
Well, you know, it's been a variety of people. I can't say that it's actually, in all honesty, done exactly what I was at first, you know, in some ways expecting it to do. And that was serve as a kind of ambassador of this understanding, almost this sort of policy narrative and reframing of the conversation. I'll have to tell you that it's primarily a kind of very specific research tool that I found people using it for more than anything else, and that what I've found is that the data has been very useful to those who understand it, who understand the policy narratives within which those data are highly compelling, and those maps, etc. Those who don't have that sort of, haven't gotten that understanding, aren't really able to use the Atlas in that sort of public education and policy rethinking way that it was designed to be used. So I have to take a hit for a little bit of that, and maybe underestimating how much active interpretation and direct sort of support it's requiring to help people use and understand these data. When we put them out within that sort of understanding, framed in this understanding of the criminal justice system, people get it right away. And the Atlas itself doesn't sort of provide that framework, I think. And so while those who know the framework use it to great effect, we're now sort of on the next stage of development in a number of ways, particularly around the Atlas, redesigning the way we help people take advantage of these maps and findings more according to the constituencies that find them useful, whether that's the media, whether that's government, or whether those are academic researchers and the lay public. So we're sort of re-specifying it now in ways that we think will be more immediately useful and understandable to those constituents.
It seems that it's a bit strange to hear you say that, because when web mapping first evolved, you know, back in the mid to late 90s, cities were very proud of the fact that they could stand up these web mapping sites, and one of the first things they seemed to put up there was the incidences of crime, and they wanted to be able to, you know, plot the different types of crime, and people even got very sophisticated with their crime analyses in looking at Rose diagrams and trying to translate that into, you know, identifying crime areas of the crime population. So maybe there's a little bit of a disconnect between the incidence of crime and the incidence of incarceration, and it seems like that's the way you got to put the two together in order to really perhaps impact policy.
That's right. That's certainly a possibility. And again, you know, in some ways, those are the crime, you know, sort of the crime mapping websites. And the use of crime mapping more broadly has been in part, you know, a component, a dimension of the crime conversation that we were looking to intervene in. And I think that's in some ways the long view we're taking of it. So that, for example, some of the primary purposes of posting crime rates in cities that cities were so excited to do had a lot to do with the drop in crime. And the certain, you know, pleasure in being able to document that drop and demonstrate it for what it was. I don't think localities are yet in a position to be, if you see what I mean, celebrating or documenting the similar phenomenon when it comes to the overuse of incarceration in their neighborhoods. So it's a very, you know, that's why it's, I think these aren't all, these tools aren't all the same, so that even if you're using a GIS tool, you know, it's all about the specificity and logic of the policy environment and narratives that you're involved in. They're not, it's not a ubiquitous tool in that sense. It doesn't have equal value. And I think that the policy discussion around incarceration, which I must say today is at a level I haven't seen in the entire 20 years I've been doing this work, or reading about it for the 30 years before, you know, that it, from which it started. Today that conversation is much more progressive and advancing than it has been in the last 30 years. So I think it's just a matter of time before we develop a more productive, useful way to talk about this process and this problem that I think is evolving before our very eyes now. And we're still helping to try to develop, guide, influence that conversation and gauge where it's most effective. And what we're finding by looking to specify now in a more careful way the constituents who use these data and are anxious to jump them on a website, etc., is that by looking at government's needs and understanding where this issue is going and what's going to be most productive for government, we're redesigning and retooling the way that data is available and useful to them. So for example, I will tell you that the next project we're working on and that our data itself has led us to work on is this understanding, growing understanding of emergency response government that is the kind of net response, last resort governance that we're seeing in these high incarceration neighborhoods. Because we're not just mapping prison and jail and probation and parole anymore. We've also been mapping TANF and Medicaid and foster care, for example. And we're, right, and when you see the overlap in the locally concentrated distributions of these services, interventions and populations, what you find in net demographic terms is a government that governs these particular neighborhoods through last resort urgent response methods, whether it's the prison, the emergency room, or the homeless shelter. And they're all responses that are designed to be individually helpful. But when you see how they overlap and concentrate disproportionately in particular places, what you find is really a net result of emergency response to places that need much more chronic care and prevention networks. And the other result is that it's an incredibly expensive way to govern those places, especially when it's it could be done less costly and much more effectively by targeting the local social health educational networks at work in those places. And we are starting to see, you know, where crime used to be a characteristic of disadvantage in a neighborhood, so is incarceration at this point. It's not simply a response to crime, but just by the demographic nature of our findings, is unintendedly perhaps a response to poverty and rape, anyway. So I think that's where, you know, that's an evolving understanding. That's not going to happen overnight. But I think that the mapping is a way that a lot of people can converse about it in terms that are understandable to everyone. And I think it will evolve, even if it is doing it in a little bit of fits and starts right now.
Wow. Eric, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really want to thank you for providing all the details about the Justice Mapping Center and your work today. And I certainly wish you a lot of luck in the future and hoping to bring this to more policymakers as well as politicians to help them solve some of these very important problems.
Well, thanks, Joe, and thanks for your interest in the issue.
Thanks again for listening to my conversation today with Eric Adora of the Justice Mapping Center. If you'd like to write to me about this interview, please send me an email at editors@directionsmag.com. Thanks again, and be sure to tell a friend.